This is August 10th, 2008. We have Dave Worster here. We're continuing our discussion, and we're going to focus on the events at the Center of Integration that was created in the 55, 56, 57 period, maybe even 54, and went till 1960. And Dave was there from 1957 on, or late 56. So I am referring to a book by the founder of the Center of Integration, Robert Carr. And he did a book called God Men, Con Men in 2003, published in India. And he has a chapter on the beginning of the center, it's called. Chapter four is the beginning of the center. But I'm going to go back to the previous couple of chapters where Bob Carr talks about the events that led him into creating the center. And I'm going to ask Dave if he recognizes any of these names. These are events in the early 50s before Dave met Bob Carr. But maybe he remembers Bob Carr talking about it. Now, I've heard a lot about Bob Carr from David. I met Bob and Connie in 69, early 1970 in Seattle one time. And I did not know the details of Bob Carr's life before Dave comes to the Center of Integration. And what I found out, Dave, was that Bob Carr became... He got into 1950, 51, 52, in Portland, he got into the local Vedanta Center. Have you ever heard of him talk about his days in the Vedanta Center in Portland?
Not much, but I believe that's where he met the Swami, and there was a health food store operator who had many stores in many cities, and he had people who would go and give talks in his, swamis and seers and so on. And apparently there was someone at the Vedanta Center, and Bob was at that center, and this health food store operator got them together and sent them on a tour. And then as a result of it, then Bob started touring himself. And he came to Seattle and appeared in a hotel set up a room. And there were about a dozen people who came to the first meeting, but those people were the ones that together set up the first steps of the Center of Integration. And I think Grace Chapman was the key, and the Millettes. There were five of the Millettes there that first time. So they were like founders. And Grace Chapman has a very interesting story because she was in the OSS and worked with some of the people I knew that were in the CIA. So I considered if she was in the OSS and they were in the CIA and they were working together, she probably was CIA. But that was probably long before meeting Bob. But she backed getting him into a house and getting a center started. But at some point, there was a disagreement, so Bob pulled the plug, moved, got new papers, put all the bank accounts in the new thing, and bought a house nearby on Capitol Hill, and took off as the Center of Integration from that point on. Of course, it should be noted that integration, as referred to in the Vedanta, in the Indian society, is psychological integration, but people weren't putting out titles like the Center of Psychological Integration, just the Center of Integration with the Asian implication of integration.
Right. Now, that's a good intro because it resonates a bit with Bob Carr's history as he presents it in this book, which may not be his own memory.
Well, now, wait a minute. Did he tell about being a magician?
Yes. Everything you mentioned so far, he touches on. But it,
did he talk about the show in Las Vegas?
I don't know. I have that is the final 10 pages I haven't read. That is.
Well, no, that was one of the things that set him the way before he ever went to Vedanta or anything else.
I know, but Dave, hold it. I started the book reading from chapter 4. And I finished the book. Then I went back, and I've been reading chapter 1, 2, and 3 just the last couple of days.
So then, any comments about why he did it? You don't know.
No, I haven't. It may be.
And I do, but you don't know because you haven't read the book so far.
No, I know the story. You've told it many times, but I don't know if he mentioned it. See, Dave, understand it's only...
All right, should it be mentioned now?
No, not yet, because we're going to go back to what you've already said. We'll get to what you're talking about, and I may be able to find it. Because
I think it's a phenomena.
I know. Dave, we're going to get to it. But the thing is that I have not read the 10 pages of the book. And you brought up the point that I was going to read in the next couple of days. But we'll get to that. But I know where it led to because I read right after that part.
All right. For the purposes of the transcribing of this, I think the phenomena that happened to him as a magician in Las Vegas and the way his mind was blown, and how he couldn't perform anymore because of it, and so he crawled into a hole, and in that hole he was found by a psychic, and turned on and became before the center of integration he'd had the best psychic bookstore in Portland.
Right, but I see scanning these 10 pages I haven't read. There seems to be slight reference to that, but we're going to come back to it, Dave.
In other words, I've laid enough foundation to refer back to it whenever,
yes,
or somebody can ask questions on it.
No, you laid a very good foundation, and the questions, I'm having this dialogue with you because I'm curious about what you remember of Carr's life and what he says. And as opposed to what Carr remembers of his own life.
Uh-huh.
Because I know enough from what I've heard from you that there's some discrepancies here.
And there's another little thing that I'm not sure we've discussed very much. But when I was working for John Graham, which is when the haunted house experience occurred, you know.
Yeah.
I was working with Bob's father, who was the architectural representative on the Lloyd Center in Portland. And it was much later after I was living at the center that he walked in the door and I said, "What are you doing here?" And he says, "What are you doing here?" And that's when I found out that here I'd known Bob Carr's father for months and months before I ever met Bob Carr, but I never related it to. But I felt that was important to mention.
No, that's great. Okay, let me go through my notes here of what Bob says, Bob Carr says, is how he became the center of integration.
Yes.
And it's pretty interesting, and we don't know if his memory is accurate or not. That's what we're going to try to find out by talking to you, and maybe he would disagree with what you remember.
Well, as I recall, of course, time has passed on. He's 80, I'm 80.
Yeah.
But as I recall, he had a pretty darn good memory.
He's got a good memory.
In some cases, he had quite a bit of attitude, but he had a good memory, I think.
Yeah, just to write what he wrote in detail indicates a good memory.
Okay.
And he did this around the year 2000, Dave. That's when he started thinking back and reviewing his whole life, just to give you a time frame. 99-2000 was when, according to this book, he sat down.
When did Connie die?
95,
so this is about 5 years after Connie died. He started writing the book, and then in 02, was it?
That it 03. Got, the date
03,
is 03.
It got published in India.
Yeah.
Did you find out whether he had any other books?
No, it seems to be the only book.
I thought I heard he had some books, so maybe this is the one somebody was referring to. Anyway, I'm sorry, not to interrupt.
It's all right. I'm not trying to cause a fight between you and Bob over the memory. It just would be great to have.
I know. I understand. You pique my interest because there's some unknowns there, and some of them may be answered, you know.
Yes, I think the combination of your memory and his will be really fill in a lot. Okay, so what happened is that he goes to the Vedanta Center. Won't go into how he finds it. Well, he goes into it, but I don't want to go into that. There's a person named Wally Cunningham. You ever heard of him, Dave?
No, is he the health food store owner?
No, but he was a very good friend of Bob's in Portland. And it doesn't say he was a health food store owner.
Unless that's who it was, I don't recall. I don't recall the name as being particularly significant, unless it's one of those names which you associate with a corporation. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay, so what happened is that Wally Cunningham was a semi-bohemian guy, just a very intriguing person, an intriguing mind for Bob. And he was fascinated by Wally's knowledge, and Wally was a little older. But Wally suggested, out of the blue, you should go see the Vedanta Center, which was right across the street from Wally's place in Portland.
Uh-huh.
So he decides to go there, and he gets involved with Swami Devatmananda.
Now, wait a minute. It's Swami who?
Devatmananda. Devatmananda, maybe that's how you say it.
Go ahead and see if there's another Swami mentioned. Go ahead.
Right, and he was a disciple of, go back to this page. There might be some gaps here, but this ain't for radio, so it'll be okay. It's the Ramakrishna Vedanta Center.
Yeah, I know a bit about that.
And Devatmananda is the resident guru representing.
Okay, all right. So he went to there, is there another Swami that he toured with?
Yes, Swami Satchidananda.
Yes. Now, wait a minute. I think so.
Yeah, no, that's Swami Ramdas he meets through this circuit, and Swami Satchidananda is part of that circle. And that's a famous name. I remember that. Satchidananda becomes big later, doesn't he?
Yeah, but I think there was another one in that was like a key man, but then there was a young up-and-coming guy who lived at the center later and went to the University of Washington and took international law.
Yes, he discussed him. We'll get to him.
And I can't remember his...
I got the name. We'll get to that.
All right.
Yeah. I'm just looking up. Remember, who's the guy... the mother. The mother, guru, because he mentions Mother Krishnabi. Is that the one that was the famous mother in the 70s? Maybe just write her name in. I'm looking on Wikipedia just to see if this comes up, because it was a question I had about... it doesn't come up. Back to Wally. Okay, so he starts hanging out... Bob Carr starts hanging out at the Vedanta Center, and he meets a kid whose parents are into theosophy. And they go, they go up to Orcas Island off of Victoria, B.C. Do you know that island?
I know.
Yeah, there was a retreat there for the Theosophical Society. Does that sound familiar?
Well, not to me, but I know there's one. I mean, intellectually, I know there's one there.
Yeah. So he isn't that interested in theosophy itself, but his friend says, hey, we can have a free trip up there, and our parents will provide for everything, his friend's parents. So when he's there, he meets second here. He meets... a Fritz Kunz and his wife Dora. You ever heard of Fritz Kunz and Dora Kunz?
I think I've heard of them, but I'm trying to place them. Whether they could have been a member of the center later. I didn't know everybody's name, but there were so many.
Yeah, no, they weren't part of the center. They're the people leading the Theosophical group on Orcas Island that Bob encounters. And they started something called the Main Currents of Modern Thought. That was the name of their organization. But what happens is he's 22. Bob's 22, and he seems to be born, doesn't give the exact date, but he seems to be born around 1928, same time as you.
Yeah.
And so this is about 1950. And this Doris Kunz, she reads auras in that, and she was doing it for the group. But then she took Bob aside and said, quote, you know, you have an opening in your aura, and there are psychic forces working there. Do you know that? She says to him when he's 22. He says, Bob says, I told her that in the last month I had some strange experiences that seemed not normal. She broke in, quote, you must be careful and keep your thought form simple and pure. That will be important. Then she said, you have the right energy for this sort of thing. Teaching will come easily to you, and you will be helped by others. Then she says, the female energy will help you. Don't reject its power. It will bring balance. Then she says, that's enough for now. So what happens is that that's said, and then he goes back to Portland, and he's attending the services at the Vedanta Temple, and he starts doing some meditation by himself, and he says, now, I don't know if this is September 50, 51, or 52, but he says, it was September, and it would soon be raining in Portland. I was spending long periods of time seated in meditation before my little shrine at home. One evening, just as I was about to finish my meditation, I started to feel dizzy and very lightheaded, as though I were going to pass out. The room began to disappear, and I fell into a deep, sleep-like state. It was different from anything I'd experienced before. This lasted for some time, and when I returned to consciousness, I felt relaxed. But my thinking was slow, and I went to bed and fell asleep. In the morning, my head was clear, and I felt full of energy. So he, that happened to him. Then he, meets two friends, Adrian and Donald. And they come over to his place one day, and he tells Donald of his experiences with meditation and how sometimes he would lose consciousness and not be able to remember anything except for the feeling that I was in another world, as it were. So they get excited and say, you want to do it now? So to... and Bob agreed. And so they met... at the studio a few hours later in the day, after he was working, he was a waiter at a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually was living above the
Bohemian.
It may have been, yeah. He mentions the Bohemian, but, you know, right. That may be later, but that's close. and he says he had to do his shift, and then they met. At 11 that evening, I lay down on my floor pad and tried to see if I could just let go and enter that state. Slowly my breathing changed and I fell into a deep sleep-like state. My mind was losing its awareness and I went out. The next thing I remember was that I was coming back to consciousness and was aware that I was conscious. Donald was all excited and Adrian appeared to be in shock. I asked what had happened. I looked at my watch. Over an hour had passed. Donald said, look, Robert, you were in some kind of a trance and you talked to us when I asked if you were all right. I didn't know if you were dead or alive. I inquired, quote, no, Bob inquires, what did I say? I can't remember anything except going out like a light. And then Donald said, I think you're psychic or something. You scared me tonight. Let me tell you, when I saw your breathing change, as did the color of your face, I thought you were in trouble. Your breathing was fast and then slow, slow. And I was worried that you were in trouble. But when I asked you, are you all right, you said in a different voice that was slow and deliberate, quote, this is when he was, Bob, this voice comes out of Bob Carr. It says, the boy is in deep sleep and we see no problem at all. Everything is... I'd love if Bob Carr heard this tape someday and he hears you laughing as we do this.
No.
I think he'd get a kick out of it. Everything is going well, the voice said. He will be a good subject. Donald is saying, we heard the voice say. The voice continued, quote, there is much work to be done. The body is healthy, and he can take the strain on the physical plane. And so, so then Bob reports his personal thinking at that point. He goes, he thinks to himself, what happened to me? Is this what Dora Kunz had told me about on Orcas Island last summer? Which would mean it is 1950 if he's 22. Yeah, it is 1950. He wonders, am I going crazy with all this occult and mystical stuff I've been going through? What to do now? So he has to go and talk to the Swami about it. And the Swami, this is Swami Devotmananda, doesn't give him satisfactory answers. I won't go into all the details. So he gets a little, he isn't helped by those guys. And that's a shock that the Vedanta guys didn't help him. So he then talks to Wally about it, Wally Cunningham. And Wally says, hey, it's okay. Wally says, if it's real, it will have a life of its own. Why don't you explore it? You're not afraid, are you? And Bob Carr says, no, I'm not. It's just that I'm not used to something that I don't understand. So then he decided to call Donald and fix a time for another session. So we bring in a new name. You know, remember the name Jim Albright? Dr. Albright. But this is down in Portland. So
yeah. Well, go ahead and maybe I'll get a...
Well, Jim Albright came over. He was a naturopathic doctor, and he brought over a tape recorder, and they recorded the session. So, so they started recording the session. So Bob started to do trances for people. I had never heard of that before when I was talking to you. Do you remember him talking about that?
Well, the thing is, after I came to the center,
which is 7 years later from this point we're talking about,
probably. I had been there for only, I think, about 2 or 3 weeks when everybody was kind of excited because Bob was going to give a trance. He hadn't given one for quite a while.
Yeah.
But then it was announced that it was going to be a final trance.
And you don't know anything about this. You just met the guy.
I was there.
But this is when you're just first there. You don't even know the scene, really, right?
No. As a matter of fact, when I heard that he was going to go in trance, I was kind of surprised. And so that was a whole new wrinkle that I was going to have to check out. And so when I went to the trance, there was a new experience for me. I'd never been to one of these that way. And it seemed that there was like a transfiguration over him. And it certainly was different from the Bob Carr that I knew. And it spoke in a, like with an Indian accent.
Different voice, definitely a different voice.
Oh, yeah. Different tone, different voice, different timbre, and different accent.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, that's something Bob doesn't talk about, but it's interesting as we work through this. We'll come back to this point because that's 7 years later. Let's go back to 1950.
All right.
And so he says, for the next few weeks, we'd meet three times a week for a session. As time went on, the sessions became less trying for me. They would last sometimes 2 or 3 hours, and many hours of tape were recorded. The questions that were asked became more personal, less general, and the answers became more direct. A few more people, friends of Dr. Albright, were coming to the evening meetings and began to ask questions and conduct a dialogue with my unseen host. You know, his own host, which you would say is like the Indian voice. Donald and Dr. Albright wanted to schedule more meetings with more people in attendance. So it started to spread. Now, there was a person who came named Nellie Harkness. Remember that?
Now. What does he say about her?
One person who came to these early sessions was Nellie Harkness, who had a feather shop just down the hall in the same building.
It was in the same building.
Yeah. When I was a teenager, I used to see her about making some feather doves and flowers that I used in my magic show. We had become friends. Now I would visit her sometimes after work or in the afternoon. She was originally from Scotland and came to this country when she was a young lady. She was now in her late 70s. Her husband had died some 2 years before, and she had no relatives or close friends to turn to. I liked her for her spirit and independence. Nellie still made her living at her shop making feather creations for the theatrical trade. She came one night as I told her about my experiences. She was interested and began... She came because he had told her about it, you know, privately, so she came. She was interested and began to come to every session. Later, she told me that she could see all... She could see colors all around me when I was in the trance state. She also told me that when she was a little girl, she could hear colors. There is a sound vibration for every color and shade. So then Bob says, we that gathered were a strange lot. From the outside, someone would think that we were ready for a mental hospital, while others thought that this was an important gift that one could benefit from. As for myself, I was getting used to my new role. I thought that this was the direction to take and that my life would never be the same again. The one question put to him while he was in trance was, how can such a young man come to know the level of wisdom that pours out of his consciousness? I thought that this was the direction to take and that my life would never be the same again. So I guess he's asking himself that question. How could such a... Then he says, the question was put to me while in trance. What is the future and what is the next step that Bob should take? The answer came clearly. Quote, the boy must dedicate his life energy to help enlighten those who come in search of guidance for the understanding of the life force. And he must direct their energy toward the final quest to know God, who is the source of the expression of life. And then Bob says, as far as I was concerned, that directive that I just quoted ended my question of what to do. It was clear to me that I must give myself over to this work. So he does that. So they decide they need a larger meeting place. So they get a big Victorian house that was up for rent, and it was right on Broadway, the main street in downtown Portland, just across the street from the offices of the Portland Journal, a large newspaper. Did you ever hear or go to that house, or is that too early?
Oh, no. That was all much earlier.
Yeah, okay. So you don't remember him talking about that house, do you?
Not particularly. I might have overheard comments and references, partly because there was a guy by the name of David Shreve. Does he mention David Shreve?
Yes, that comes up later, yes.
All right. Now, I'm not sure whether that house was the one Shreve had.
Okay, no, I don't know about that, but let's carry on. He says they decide to call the new place The Center, in quotes, The Center. It seems the Vedanta Temple was called the Vedanta Center sometimes, or the Vedanta Temple. But he says there were rumors at the Vedanta Temple. See, I'm thinking that I thought he says the Vedanta Center earlier, and that they said, well, we're a center like the Vedanta Center, you know? We're similar. And so that's maybe why they came up with the term center. But anyways, they just call it the center. And... there were rumors at the Vedanta Temple about what I was doing, and of course that created distance between us. So he stopped his regular attendance at the Vedanta Temple and was wholly committed to his new role. And this goes on, I don't know, for a few weeks, days, months, or something. But here's the next important event. Some point after this, he said people wanted to see me. People were curious. They started coming from Southern California and Canada. People were curious and wanted to see and take part in the meetings that now were lasting 2 to 3 hours at a time, and more sessions were needed to accommodate the request. People wanted to see me in private, and that would take a half hour or more per session. I could only do so much. There was only so much time available. The strain was making me lose my voice on occasion. I would have to rest, and then I would be all right. Now, when you meet Bob and you're there in 50, is it late 56, early 57? It's that period.
I don't know exactly when. It was late 56, early 57.
Yeah. So you're recovering. You're recovering from the haunted house, and Bob comes in and gives you The First and Last Freedom, right? By Krishnamurti.
Well, when I first met him, it was at Keith Reinhardt's. Place. Keith Reinhardt was a psychic who had a church. And somebody, while I was going through my explorations, somebody wanted me to go see Keith Reinhardt. I didn't want to go, but I went. And Bob Carr was called up as a guest to read auras. So as far as I was concerned, he was of the same ilk as Keith Reinhardt.
Yeah.
And so later when this other gal who had been in the OSS, which was
Lucia Raymond? Is it?
No. Eclair Olson.
Yes. I met her.
Had tried to get me to go to the Center of Integration several times. And she wanted me to talk to Bob. And I said, but I already saw him. I see what he's up to, and I wouldn't go.
Yeah.
Well, finally, after quite some time, there was a dinner at the center. And so she got me to go to the dinner, which was all laid out in the tables were in the drawing room area and the dining room area. And so it was kind of festive. I think they served Indian food, too. Anyway, Bob got up and spoke for about 10 minutes, and this time it was like a different thing for me. Enough so that I made an appointment to see him the following day in his office. So when I was with him for a short period of time, he says, look, a lot of people are probably pushing you around and trying to get you to do things. And he says, you don't have to pay attention to that. Most of their stuff is crap. And he says, what you're doing is probably pretty good, and it's best you not do all that. And then he showed me around the center, and there was a basement apartment available. And so I rented it. And then after I was moved in, all of a sudden I just went into a state. I didn't leave the place for 2 weeks. I had apparition appear before me that was a short brown man, I felt. And it's not that anything was spoken, but I could experience all kinds of energies, and I would write down what I was going through. So I wrote many pages. Anyway, after I'd been down there for about 2 weeks, Bob knocked on the door, and when he came in, I didn't know what to say. I even forgot to ask him to show him where to sit down, so he pulled a stool up and sat down on a stool. And I wasn't saying anything, so he just kind of went into a meditation. You know, he did say something about, we wondered what had happened to you, because we hadn't seen you since, thought maybe you'd come up to some meetings and stuff. And I couldn't say anything, and that's when he sat on the stool and kind of meditated. He said, just a minute. And so he got up and left, and in just a few minutes he was back. And he just opened the door a little bit and handed me these two books. And he looked me straight in the eyes and he said, just so you don't think you're unique. And that was Krishnamurti's First and Last Freedom and Joel Goldsmith's The Infinite Way. And as I started looking at them, at some point I went over and looked at the things I'd written down and found that there was such a correlation. Like, so anyway, as I read the two books and my stuff.
Yes. Okay.
And then after that,
we've talked about that. I think on the Eben, we have that on tape about you remarking on the similarity of your writings, word for word, to what Krishnamurti had published.
Yeah, that had apparently been channeled even before I got the book. But that's just a possibility, you know.
Right. Now, here's all this is relevant to the point I'm going to bring up, because here he is. He's starting to give these sessions and be a medium. In other words, he's doing what you later do when you channel cosmic awareness. People are coming.
Not really, but
No. I don't mean on the outer level, he is going into trance like you later did and serving people's questions, right?
Yeah, but he's doing it through entities that I never did.
Right.
Okay.
But the thing is that I never knew that he had done this, and it's interesting to me to find out that he had a similar experience before you. a similar experience for you. But here's
what happened. But you can see why he could understand me right away.
Yeah, yeah. And I did not know that till I read his biography, autobiography, why he would know it. So the amazing thing is that very early in this period of giving sessions, I don't have a clue. I don't know how long it made. Let's say he's been doing it for a year, so it's 51, 52. He says one day the doorbell rang. One morning the doorbell rang, and when I opened the door, there was an older woman standing there. She had a large shopping bag that was full of books, which she wanted to donate to our library. I did not know her, but she said that she had attended some of my meetings, and would I like to leave the books, and would I like her to leave the books at the center? Of course, I said, taking the books, not knowing what they were. I asked her if she wanted to come in. She said, no, I have to be on my way. I thanked her and watched her walk down the steps onto the busy street. When I opened the bag, now this is really interesting, I found that they were all paperback verbatim reports, and that's capitalized, verbatim reports of talks by J. Krishnamurti dating back to the early 30s and on up to the present. That's quite a find or gift.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
He said, I had never seen the books before. He had heard of Krishnamurti a little bit, but he had never seen the books before. I mean, he had heard of Krishnamurti, and he goes, what a find, I thought, and put them in my room. So he knew enough about Krishnamurti that this was significant, but he hadn't really studied Krishnamurti. He said, as I began to read the talks, I realized that I was reading something that seemed new and fresh, not the old line that all religious teachings prescribe. There was a break from the traditional methods and ideas that the so-called great religions teach. The more I read, the more obvious this became. Then he goes, have I been searching in the wrong places for truth? Krishnamurti's ideas were revolutionary to me, an all-out attack on my own belief structure to its very core. I had as yet no idea of the impact they would have on me in my life. And they would have a tremendous, I'm saying this, they have a tremendous impact. So this is how he found out. This is how he's affected by Krishnamurti, by this lady showing up and just dropping off these very obscure books.
In Portland, and this would have been, what, about 52,
in that period. So then what happens, he says, I was also growing more aware of what was happening in the sessions. I could now hear the questions that were asked and the discourses that would follow. There was less separation between the voice and myself, and the presence that one felt during the discourses was becoming a more permanent part of me. The sessions were more like a meditation, and I was seeing more and more of the state of the human condition. I could see and feel the sorrow, the emptiness that human beings are filled with. Often the discussions would leave me with my own sense of pain and wanting to escape from it. He says, Krishnamurti's ideas became more and more a part of my life. My thinking was affected by what he said. I thought of how nice it would be to see and hear him when he was in Ojai, but I did not know when or where he might be giving talks, nor was I in contact with anyone who knew. Now, I'll jump ahead. He doesn't get to experience Krishnamurti for another 7 or 8 years in 1960.
Yeah, I know.
And you were there at that experience.
I didn't go to the 60 talks.
Oh,
I was in the. I stayed behind and continued the meetings and stuff at the center.
But
and as a matter of fact,
Dave
I brought.
Oh, go ahead.
As a matter of fact, there was a Swami that somebody saw in Canada and sent him down to see us. And when he came, I didn't know what to do, so I called Vivian, who hadn't yet gone to Ojai. And so she arranged for Premanand to come and stay and talk. And then she went down to Ojai and she told Bob and Connie about it. Everything seemed to be okay until they got back, and it turns out he had used a steam iron on their lacquer coffee table, an Indian antique, in their bedroom. And it was all clouded. Oh, that was, I was really in the trouble for that.
You were?
Yeah. Yeah, because I was responsible.
Right. Now, but it's at those sessions you heard the stories of young Dave Millett running around down there at those sessions. Was it those ones that
I saw him. I don't know about in those. I don't think he was anything in Portland.
No. At the Krishnamurti Ojai 1960 talks that affected.
Oh, yeah.
Dave Millett was there, and you had some stories about that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you would have heard Dave Millett and the Millett family's interpretation of what happened to Bob Carr when he saw Krishnamurti. You know what I mean? That would be your...
Not very much. It was too much about David.
Oh, okay. Right.
But I heard from others.
Yes.
I heard from others Connie was there, and Vivian and Isabel, I think, was too. And
okay, well,
there was about 15 people went down to it together.
Right. Okay. Now that's 7 or 8 years later from the point we're talking about. So here's Bob privately being affected by Krishnamurti.
Yes.
He says, I was hoping to see Krishnamurti someday. How strange. People came to see me for help, and I, in my own way, sought help from another. He was starting to think he needed help from Krishnamurti. I had no real plans other than keeping the little center going. I was quite happy with my new lifestyle, and I decided to cut down the number of the trance sessions to limit them to just 2 a week. So he's starting to feel, quote, a little guilty about doing this. You know what I mean? And he goes into this later, what I just referred to. So he says, in September 53, a famous philosopher, Dr. Gilbert, shows up. You ever heard of him, Dr. Gilbert?
This is in Portland still, isn't it?
Yeah, and he's giving talks at the Masonic Temple.
Oh, I see. No, I don't think so.
Okay, so Dr. Gilbert comes to him and has a private reading, which has struck Bob strange. Here's this almost guru kind of guy coming and asking Bob questions about his personal life. In the personal reading, it came out that Gilbert was having an affair, and not just one. He had lovers in all the cities in which he lectured. It also came out that his wife knew nothing about his activities.
All I can say is, you know, there's this comedian, Craig Ferguson, is on all the time, and he sometimes will make some kind of a comment, and then he'll stop and look at it, and then he'll come toward the camera, and he says, does it remind you of anyone?
Yeah, so he came out that his wife knew nothing about his activities. He said that he was oversexed and the drive was too strong. He felt guilty and did not know what to do about his marriage. And then the session goes on and goes into details. So Bob, when Gilbert leaves, he goes, how strange, the blind leading the blind.
Oh, yes, that's good.
Yeah, he says, I did see Gilbert again several times and learned that his wife had divorced him and that he had remarried and become a successful minister. This gave me a tremendous insight. No one person had the answers, and those who claimed to have the answers were no different than those who sought them.
Uh-huh.
So, do you remember the name Ann Love, a friend of Nellie? You don't remember this Nellie Hartness, do you?
Oh, I sure do. She had acid sessions with us and danced with Valentino while she was on it.
Okay, so we didn't get that.
But this Ann Love?
Yeah, she looked after Nellie because Nellie was older.
I obviously saw her or something.
Well, I'm not sure, but anyway, just you may have as we get to more events. But what happened is that, so at the center, at the Portland Center, it's Nellie and Ann Love, and she became a regular member of the center. And so then Nellie got cancer or something, and Bob goes into trance and tells her what to do, and I think he goes into trance, maybe he just said it. Let me see. He did go into trance. So he ends up helping Nellie, and the tumor goes away, the breast tumor. So that was a little miracle. He actually healed her. That's a record of him healing her. He says, just jumping ahead, Nellie lived to her mid-80s and died of old age in a small house she shared with Ann Love. But that would be back in Portland. See, Nellie comes to Seattle later, but then goes back, I think.
Yeah, I think she just made a trip. It was arranged because he probably wanted her to experience the experience that she did.
Right, right. Okay, so, but she does stay there for a while, but not permanently. So, here, as a result of, he meets Swami Prabhavananda. Does that mean anything? P-R-A-B-H, Prabhavananda, a Swami who knew Aldous Huxley, and they had visited Krishnamurti. So he gets to talk to these people a bit about Krishnamurti. Here's a little more about it. And he then speaks to Swami Devatmananda, and this is after Bob has left the Vedanta Society, not officially, but there's a bit of tension because he's giving his own readings and not going to their courses or lectures. But he goes back to this party and he sees Swami Devadmananda, and he says, "Oh, Krishnamurti." So Bob asks him, "Oh, Krishnamurti." Bob's very curious about this guy, character, Krishnamurti. "Looking at me," Devadmananda said, smiling, "Oh, an intellectual juggler, just words. But why do you ask?" And Bob says, "Well, I've been reading his talks and I find them more than interesting." And then Devadmananda says, "What he has to say is not new at all, as he claims. What he says can be found in the Upanishads. Why do you read his books? Are you not studying here with your guru, Swami Devadmananda?" So actually, it's Prabhavananda who's saying all this about Krishnamurti.
Ah.
And so then Prabhavananda smiled again and turned away to disappear in the crowd. So Bob says, "I think that exchange ended my connection with Vedanta and the Swamis. But what did I expect anyway, asking that kind of a question?" You know, bringing up Krishnamurti.
Right.
So that is a turning point. He doesn't go back to the Vedanta Center. So Dr. Gilbert comes back, or actually calls from Seattle and asks if Bob would go up and do some readings in Seattle, which is...
So Gilbert...
Yeah. So it was, you mentioned that an hour ago. You remember him being asked to come up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it was actually Gilbert.
So what time factor did he mention this?
This is 53.
53?
Yeah.
Okay.
53 going into 54 because they don't get up to Seattle till summer 54 or something like that. Okay, but here he is. He's being asked to go up to Seattle. He's basically never been there before. And he thought he would go. He says, he's thinking, I could give a series. Okay. Dr. Gilbert called me one day from Seattle and asked if I would like to come and be part of a demonstration Gilbert was giving in a series of workshops. I could give a series of readings on my own to help cover my expenses. My immediate reaction was to say yes. That would open up doors in Seattle for me, as I had not been there before. My friends Donald and Dr. Albright thought it was a good idea too. So I packed a suitcase and took the train to Seattle. There was a room reserved for me at the Stewart Hotel. Remember you mentioned the hotel?
The Stewart. Is that? I wasn't sure of which one it was.
Yeah. But you remember hearing Bob talk about this, I guess.
Yeah, but I wasn't sure was the Stewart or the Mayfair or the Moore. But, okay, the Stewart. Stewart is right. You know, they're all in the same neighborhood.
Right, and this is assuming that Bob's memory is accurate.
Mm-hmm.
There was a room reserved for me at the Stewart Hotel where Dr. Gilbert was giving his lectures. I would give a demonstration with Dr. Gilbert guiding the questions in the general direction of the session. The evening event was sold out and was a success both in attracting a new group of people and in raising money to cover my expenses. During the day, I was booked completely, giving 30-minute readings all day. There was a long reservation list, and I decided to stay on an extra day. So, he meets two people as a result of this experience in Seattle. You know, after 2 days of seeing as many people as I could schedule, I was exhausted and my voice was so strained I could barely speak. And he says, there were two ladies that stood out from the rest who seemed to have a special interest. Phyllis Good. He writes Phyllis Good here, but it's later Phyllis Goodall. You ever heard of her?
Yes, she was the secretary a nurse in the offices of Edgar Casey.
Right.
And helped transcribe and record and... in sessions with Casey at Virginia Beach.
Very good, Dave. That's exactly who she is. And what's interesting, though, you have this stream coming from the Casey world ending up in your group. You know what I mean? That's what's interesting. She's picking up the pieces and entering a new scene on the West Coast. He says, Phyllis, is it Good or Goodall? Because he has Good.
Goodall.
Yeah. Phyllis Good, or it should be Goodall, all introduced... he's got Phyllis Good... Space A-L-L. Oh, okay. It's a typo. Phyllis Goodall introduced herself to me and told me that she had never seen an aura before in her life. And during the demonstration, she had seen a brilliant glow of colors around my head and shoulders, golden blue to be specific. She added that she knew Edgar Casey, the famous clairvoyant. She had worked in Virginia Beach with his foundation, and never in her life had she seen what she saw the previous night with Bob Carr. I was somewhat taken aback by her rather strong presence, but there was something about her I liked. She was very direct, and at the same time, there was an even feeling about her. There was an even feeling about her. Then he goes, Grace Chapman was the other lady.
Aha!
Bingo! That's who you cited. You remember an hour ago, you were talking about an hour ago, about the hotel, and you brought in Grace, right? You knew Grace had some kind of connection to it.
I thought in the first meeting, but then this trip where he came up to do this, I think is different from the one which occurred that I talked about. But maybe it's the same one.
Okay, we'll see.
Because they only had about a dozen people or less in that.
In the hotel meeting.
Yeah.
Yeah. They kept them busy. They must have all had sessions then, because...
Well, if it's the same ones, but I don't think so.
The same...
I feel as though he came up to the Stewart and did that trip, left, went back, and then came up again.
Yes, but you're saying that the one you're... What's the one that has 12 people? The first one or a later one?
What I thought was the first time he... It was the time that he spoke... in Seattle, and the Millettes. See, five Millettes went.
Yeah, but that's not this.
Huh?
I don't think this is the earlier.
I don't think they were at the earlier one, but I don't know.
Right, okay, let's just
leave only have heard about the one that I think is a different one.
Okay, good. Let's just leave it at this, assuming this is an earlier one, and this is where he meets Grace Chapman.
I guess.
And you're saying that Grace Chapman invited him up to the one that the Millettes went to?
Well, I assumed that
that
because of the foundation being with Grace Chapman, that she was one of the 12 who was there.
But
she may have sponsored
12...
it and just known him, and then they did it anyway. So I don't have any reference. I'd have to find out from David or Mary if Grace Chapman was present at that, the Millettes.
Which was only 12 is what you're
well,
saying.
Well, I that's a guesstimation. Yeah. I don't remember the figure. It could have been 10. I knew that most of them were the Millettes.
Right. Right. But the point is, he's got more than 12 happening on this event with Dr. Gilbert, because he goes for three
right.
days. Okay, so Grace Chapman was the other lady. She had searched, she told Bob, all her life, going through one thing after the other. But what came through me was the highest, she said. I didn't feel she was as balanced as Phyllis, but she was sincere. So he thanked Gilbert and goes back. Now, looking at my notes here as we move along. all right, so
So he went back to Portland.
Yes, but what... so this Anne Love hooks in at this point, and she wants to really personally get connected to Bob, but she used the excuse of she will help Nellie. So she moves into Bob's center in Portland, and he tried to keep his distance from Anne, because Anne was 20 years, no, I don't know if this was the cause, but she was 20 years older and had a failed marriage behind her. And she sought solace in the spiritual search, trying to escape her loneliness. In the evening, now here's an interesting thing. In the evenings, he would keep his distance and stayed downstairs working on the material that was recorded by Dr. Albright of his own sessions. In the evenings, I would go out with my friend Rick Dahlstrom. Is that a name you remember?
I think I've heard it, but I don't remember why.
Okay, he said, we would make the rounds and I would not get back till late in the morning. Now, Bob...
Make the rounds. We would make the rounds. Okay.
And that implies the homosexual lifestyle, because he talks
Absolutely.
About...
Absolutely.
Yeah, he talks about being homosexual earlier and this and that. But I think he's bisexual, like you, Dave. He goes like this. I'm assuming you're bisexual, but there are indications you might be bisexual, Dave, right? because Bob is bisexual, because he says he's avoiding Anne Love, but I should have known better because the living arrangement was not working out. Anne had definite ideas about what she wanted, and that was a relationship with me. That was not in my cards. I had no intention of becoming her lover, but I made the fatal mistake of sleeping with her on one occasion. So he could perform. And he goes,
but he, oh, you're funny.
Yeah. Trying to be funny here. He made the fatal mistake of sleeping with her on one occasion. And he goes, that did it. it. She told, Ann told Nellie about it while I was in Seattle giving another series of lectures.
All right.
And readings to a newly formed group of friends. That's probably the Millett case.
I see. So she, he used them as a way to escape
yeah.
Love.
Yeah, and love. That's right. Yeah. So Seattle was giving me more support than I'd been getting in Portland. There are invitations to consider, and I had plans to make my base in Seattle. That would entail a move, and I would have to think about that. The new friends in Seattle were in a better position to offer real support and to help establish a center for my work. When I returned to Portland, things were a bit calmer. However, I had to deal with Anne. I had to try to make her understand that it would be impossible for her to continue living in the center and that I could have no relationship with her except as a friend. She flew into a rage and stormed out of the room saying all kinds of things about me. The way Bob writes, he's in a way he's not a very good writer. He doesn't give the details that you might want to hear. We would like to hear the kind of things she said about him. But
well, it's like he holds the cards pretty close to his... You've got to remember he's a magician.
That's right.
And the magician's always protecting his gaffe. You know what a gaffe is?
No.
The mechanism by which he does his magic.
Oh,
all
okay.
These different mechanisms that they have are their gaffe. So you see one magician walk up to someone else and see them doing a magic act, and it's all over. Then they'll come up and say, now, what's the gaffe?
Right.
Okay, now, with Bob, he mentally asked that about everything. I became very familiar with it because he even used it as a kind of a colloquialism in my presence. And, well, what's the gaffe about that? But as far as, I think at one point he was going to accuse me of having a gaffe over going into the transfer awareness, but
that's years later.
Story.
That's years later, right. But here's what, Dave, you're correct, because he does.
Yeah, but it goes back to this thing about him giving the last trance at the center that I told you about.
Right, but let's get to that. Okay. I want to supplement what you just said. You're exactly right. He does say that, you know, as a late teenager, he was a very successful magician and all that, and he thinks that part of his ability to do this trance session was his acting and magical training. He acknowledges
yeah.
That prepared him, in a way.
Well, what it did is it got him to moving like that thing of passing out six cigarettes. Only one night, it was nine cigarettes, lit cigarettes, and he didn't know where the other three came from, and that's when he went to Portland and met Nellie and all the rest of it, you know.
Right. I'm going to, that is the part that I haven't read. That's the Las Vegas experience you were going to talk about an hour ago. We'll come back to that and see. I will try to scan it and see if he brings that up. It's
uh-huh.
Okay. But back, yes, he's holding things close. That he talks about when he knew that at the center he had to keep his distance from everybody. That was a magical trick. You know, you can't be a guru if you're hanging around and hanging out. You know? So he psychologically used the gaffe of separateness and laying low and not really having his private life he did with Rick Dahlstrom and, you know, on the sly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know.
So he says, she flew into a rage and stormed out of the room saying all kinds of things about me. I mean, when you're a writer, you might say you might fill in what someone said just to create interest in your writing, but you don't write, a guy doesn't write a novel and say, oh, then Bill said a whole bunch of stuff at me and I said a bunch of stuff back to him.
Well, mentally he's probably trying to get rid of her real fast again.
Yeah. Yes, while he was writing this, you mean? In his memory.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. He didn't want to go into it. It's probably accurate.
Yeah. Why dredge up, yeah. You know.
Yeah, that's it. She flew into a rage, started up saying all kinds of things about me. That's cute. I just had to close the door to try and escape her fury. That's a metaphor for what he's doing when he's writing the book. He closes the door to try and escape her fury and what she said. He's actually talking about how he's writing here, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah, that's what you just said. Okay.
Yep.
I just had to close the door to try and escape her fury. I had made a mess, and I would have to set things right by ignoring the whole thing.
I had to set things right by ignoring the whole thing. Now, that is a classic key thing, not only for him, but for many, many people, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's fantastic. We should take this and put up in a plaque.
Oh yeah.
I had made a mess, though, and have to set things right by ignoring the whole thing.
You sell a million of them.
Finally, we have the truth, the accurate aphorism. This is the real true one. And he says, ignoring the whole thing and trying somehow to make Anne understand. So maybe he means he would ignore all the things she said and he would just be nice
well,
to her
yeah.
or something. Okay. She did move out after a few days but wanted to continue attending the center. Perhaps she thought that I would cool off and come to accept her. I told her she was welcome to come to the center. I could not stand in the way of her interest in understanding herself. So that was that. And, you know, he's getting ready to move to Seattle because he's getting problems in Portland. But here's this chapter about the beginning of the center and why he moves to Seattle ends with his encounter with a psychic, what turns out to be a fake psychic kind of guy who does these seances. His name was Kenneth Richards. What was the name?
No, Greinhardt. Did he say Richards?
Kenneth Richards.
No, he put a new name in there. Kenneth Reinhardt.
Well, I've heard the name Kenneth Reinhardt, but wasn't that in Seattle?
Kenneth Reinhardt became very famous.
Yeah, through Shirley MacLaine, right? Didn't Shirley MacLaine make him famous in the 80s?
I don't think so. I don't think he was connected with her.
Okay, but I recognize the name. But the point is, that's a guy, he's in Seattle.
But I ran across his handiwork as I went across the country, and I would appear, people would, because he did some real tricky manifestations of jewels that were junk and made people pay fortunes for them, provided they never had them appraised.
You're right. That's exactly what this guy does. He would do that a little later.
See, that's the place that I first went to where I saw Bob Carr up on the stage reading auras to us.
Yeah, but remember, this is in...
That was Kenneth Reinhardt.
Okay, this is Kenneth Richards in Portland. Do you think it's a Portland?
No, it's not Kenneth Richards. It's Kenneth Reinhardt in Seattle.
Well, okay, if I Google him, he started in Portland. Does that make sense?
I don't know. I don't know. Well, anyway, read on and see.
So he's invited to a... He says, one afternoon they came over to talk about the psychic abilities of a young medium that was giving seances in Portland. His name was Kenneth Richards. They wanted to know what I thought about seances and whether it was possible to contact the dead. Well, Bob Carr says, perhaps. Then Jeff asked if I would go with him to a seance to test Ken's mediumship. Sure, I said, when and where. So they go to the session, and to Bob, after a while, it's obvious that this guy's a fake. But the guy calls Ron.
He's even a poor magician.
Yeah, yeah. And he says, is this somebody maybe into... Kenneth gives a little well-rehearsed little talk to the newcomers and how they could make contact with their loved ones. He says, in this evening seance, the spirits will levitate a metal trumpet that will float
around
the room.
That's Reinhardt.
And they will create a voice that will manifest inside the horn that will help amplify the sound. Also, a gift from the spirits, a gem or stone, will be manifested in the horn.
He was doing it in Portland?
Yeah. And Bob Carr encountered him at that point. In, you know, the 53, 54.